Author Jeff Kisseloff's new book, Rewriting History, is a political history that looks to uncover the innocence of alleged communists by Alger Hiss. Kisseloff brings to light a wealth of original material, including 150,000 pages of mostly unredacted, previously unreleased FBI files. The new book is Rewriting History, that's HISSTORY, a 50-year journey to uncover the truth about Alger Hiss, and we welcome Jeff Kisseloff to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you on this 50-year journey? What was the impetus?
Justice. It started out as a job, not more than a job. I believe that Alger Hiss was innocent. I had studied his case in college, and I wanted to help out. I wrote Alger a letter and said, do you need any help reading your FBI files? And he wrote me back and said he did. And I went to work for Alger. We studied the FBI files. We ended up filing a writ of coram nobis to overturn the case. And we ran into one judge after another appointed by Richard Nixon. And it ended up going nowhere. And I just refused to be satisfied that that was the end of it. And I just stuck with it and stuck with it until, 500 drafts of a book later, I ended up with the book that you've seen now. I just needed to see this to the end. I guess it's a unique personality that just says I have to find justice and get justice for somebody. And I think I did.
The story starts in 1948 when, earlier actually, but let's say 1948 when Whitaker Chambers accuses Hiss of being a secret communist spy in the 30s. And so many of us know about the perjury trials, and they were sensational trials, they were significant trials, and ultimately Hiss is convicted. So in the timeline, about what year are you brought into this?
I'm not that old. I came in.
I realize that.
1975.
Okay.
When Alger really had nothing. He was working for a stationery company. A group called the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee agreed to pay for his Freedom of Information Act case. He had no researchers working for him, really, except for just a few, nobody part-time. And I was the kid that came along and said, I know everything about the case. I'd like to help you. They actually didn't hire me. I mean, they just refused to hire me. It took two visits to the office for them to agree to take me on even as a volunteer. At some point, I got so frustrated, I said, maybe I'll go work for Whitaker Chambers at this point. It just got really frustrating until somebody who worked for Alger stood and listened to him talk to me in the office and said, Alger, you're crazy. This kid knows everything about the case. He doesn't want a nickel. He just wants to help you out. How could you not hire him? And so Alger said, okay, we'll take him on.
How did you reach the point where you knew that he was not guilty?
So I was in college. I was a junior. I tried to find a course that I liked, and I couldn't find one. And I convinced a professor, I had always read about the case and had always been fascinated by it. And I said, look, can I get credit if I studied everything about the case and then wrote a paper on it? And he said, okay, I'll do that. And I started to read through the HUAC hearings. And very early on, it became clear to me that there was something wrong with Whitaker Chambers' story, which was he said Alger Hiss was the closest friend I had in the underground. And yet in executive session, when they asked him for details about Hiss's life, he couldn't remember anything. He thought Hiss was deaf. He wasn't. He thought Hiss was 5'8". He wasn't. He didn't remember anything about his stepson having this terrible bicycle accident where he almost lost his leg. It was just one detail after another that he just had no idea about. And it just seemed to me that there was very basically wrong at that point with Chambers' story. And if he was lying about this, then he's probably lying about the other things too.
Once you come to that thought and that conclusion, then how much are you on your own? How much are you working with Alger Hiss? How many? I assume you still have a lot of questions, though, right?
I do, and it's very true. And one of the, I just got just a damning review and commentary. And one of the things that, you know, I noted in my response on my website was I actually spent time talking to Hess. And I found that to be an advantage as a reporter. When I went to journalism school, the first thing they tell you is, if your grandmother says she loves you, check it out. And when Alan Weinstein was writing all of these things about Alger being a liar, Alger was sitting next to me. And the defense files that Weinstein said were so crucial to his decision when he said that Alger was guilty were actually just behind my desk. And I would say to Alger, look, Weinstein says this. He makes this very clear. And he says that this is based on the defense files. And he'd say, okay, well, open that drawer, go look into that folder and go see what it says. And I would pull out the folder and I would look at Alger in a whining voice. I would say, but it doesn't say what Weinstein says it does. And he would say, yeah, you're right. And then somebody else said to me, a fellow named Bill Rubin, who was researching the case for many years, he said, Weinstein is very impressive unless you know the trial record. So I spent a lot of time reading the trial record and the appeal and all of that, and then comparing that with the defense files and then comparing that with the FBI files. And I, one of the things that I found was the FBI didn't really believe the case. In fact, when we sued to get an unredacted version of the file, which was the last 10 years, I got 120,000 pages of unredacted files. And it was really clear from there that the FBI really got involved in this case to get a conviction. And they would, I would find these reports that would be almost 100 pages long in which they were trying to get proof that Alger Hiss was a communist. And the report would conclude, no evidence to say that Hiss was a communist. I'd see this over and over again. So they didn't even believe it. And when Venona came out, the FBI didn't believe it either. They spent 2.5 years trying to figure out if Hiss was this guy Alice. And they concluded that they couldn't make a choice. And if J. Edgar Hoover wouldn't believe it, then why should I?
What was it about the FBI and the position they were in that made it so important for them to have a conviction?
Oh, J. Edgar Hoover was the number one cop in America, the number one anti-communist cop in America. Mm-hmm. This was the most publicized case in the country at the time. And it was widely, the Pumpkin Papers and the hearings were so sensational. And, you know, in 1950 or 1948, if somebody called you a communist, you were really in trouble, whether it was true or not. And J. Edgar Hoover couldn't afford to have to lose this case, because if the FBI lost the case, that was one thing. But if the FBI lost a communist case, that would certainly be something else. And he did work for the Justice Department, which prosecuted the case. So the agents were really pushed to win this thing. And believe me, they had a lot of work on their hands. Whitaker Chambers and Esther Chambers, these were not good witnesses. Esther Chambers in particular was just a train wreck in court. She was just a disaster. And one of the things that people don't know is that 3 days after Hiss was indicted, Esther Chambers ran over and killed a woman in Baltimore. And that was suddenly reduced to a traffic charge. And I always wanted to know how that happened, that a woman being killed by a speeder was suddenly, it was a traffic court charge. Well, it was an elderly African-American woman, so that was one thing. But the transcript of that trial and the research that went into it, they don't exist anymore. They suddenly disappeared from the court, and I had veteran Baltimore reporters try to dig it out for me, and they couldn't find it.
When you look at the information that came out that ultimately you were looking at, and these pages of FBI files and so forth, new information, but also information that bolsters your story all along, right? I mean that sort of proves what you had suspected.
I need to preface this by saying people used to ask me all the time, how do you work for this guy who was convicted? And I always said that if I thought that Alger did not give me an answer that was satisfying, or if I saw something in the documents that made me believe that he was guilty, I would get up and walk out of the office. And I'm a reporter. I'm loyal to my readers. I'm not loyal to my subject. And that's something that's always been drummed into me. And so when I started to look at these documents, and it just becomes just so perfectly obvious that they were covering up what the truth was in the case. And but the FBI, they were about getting a conviction. I don't think that they framed Hiss. I think they were the ones that were basically handed a gift in terms of this typewriter and other aspects of the technical aspects of the story. But they worked over the prosecution witnesses and the defense witness pretty well to make sure that there was a conviction.
Let's talk about that evidence for a moment. You acquired the Woodstock 230099, the machine that the government claimed was used to type the copies of State Department documents placed in evidence against Alger Hiss. What does that piece of equipment help you determine?
Well, several things. One thing was that in the motion for a new trial, the defense hired a scientist who was just brilliant. And he took a look at the typewriter and he looked at other typewriters and he noticed that key type bars were dripping solder on 230099, while that did not appear on any other machine. And the government's answer was, he was lying. It appears on a lot of other machines. So one of the things that I did was get on eBay and I bought 20 typewriters, which were of the same vintage, and then had a great photographer take pictures of the type bars and blow them up from all angles. And then we were able to see that almost every instance, the solder did not appear to be dripping on any of the other typewriters, only on 230099. So that was one thing that absolutely convinced me that the defense was telling the truth. The other thing was the typewriter told us that Priscilla Hiss could not have typed the documents because they were living for most of the period that Chambers accused her in a house that was 13 feet wide in Georgetown. It had no insulation. The neighbors to the north of the house, on the north side of the house, could hear Alger in the bathroom in the morning. The neighbors in the south could hear Tim Hobson playing piano all the time and drove them crazy. But nobody on the block, nobody in the front, in the back, or nobody ever heard the typewriter being used. And they would have. And I took the typewriter and I took a tape recorder, put it two rooms away from my office, turned on the tape recorder, went back and typed on the machine, and then listened to the tape. And I could hear the typing as clear as a bell from much further away than the neighbors would have. So that was one thing that told me. And then just one step beyond that was a logical step. If Alger Hiss was a prized espionage agent, and he was somebody who the Russians tried to protect, why would the hell would they have Priscilla Hiss typing all night for a year? I mean, every night, when all the neighbors could hear and everybody would be suspicious about what was going on. She wasn't writing a book. She wasn't producing anything. What was this about? And you don't raise that kind of suspicion about a spy. If you're the Russians, you want to go very, very covert. And you're not going to allow any kind of suspicious about the people that are working for you. And people just would have, they would have asked too many questions. They had to protect their agents. And in this case, she wasn't typing and she also wasn't an agent. It just didn't happen. I mean, I just kept finding this out by doing old-fashioned reporting, going to that building, taking a look at it. The story just started to fall apart piece by piece.
Once you came to your conclusion and you had the documents and you had the proof that you needed, how much, and because of the timeline here of Hiss's passing, how much were you able to let him know about?
None. And it's very sad. I mean, he knew that I was still interested in the case and doing some research. His son certainly did. But the big gift that we got was in 1997, the year after he died, when a judge released the grand jury minutes of the case. And that was, one day we got 4,000 pages of documents. It was a fantastic goldmine of information. And it was magic for us. And of course, Alger had been gone for a year, but by that time. But I think Alger knew that eventually his story would be told. I think he had faith that it would be. He was sort of very confident about that. He didn't doubt that at some point the truth would come out.
Why is it so difficult for the truth to come out in cases like this?
Well, I think people are just wedded to their story. You have historians who basically make their careers on the fact that Alger was guilty or believed to be guilty, and they won't look otherwise, or they have a theory that they believe is true, and there's no other theory that's possible. And what I think I did was say, let's start with a blank slate. Tony and Hiss and I always said to each other that we're out for the truth. Wherever the truth was going to take us, that's where we were going to go. And I did the kind of digging that really, I'm not saying this egotistically because I've seen all the research. I did the kind of digging that really nobody else did except for maybe Myers-Elex and Friendship and Fratricide back in 1967. And you also had a problem when Hiss books would come out, and if the book was a pro-Hiss book, you really had newspapers and magazines lined up against him to basically back them in the teeth. It was always very hard to get a good review of a book that suggested that Hiss was innocent.
But you're suggesting that's the case now, too.
It certainly did happen in commentary, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
But I expected that. I mean, Harvey, I met Harvey Clare only on one occasion, and I caught him in a lie. And I'm sure, and that's in the book, and I am sure that did not sit well with him. And he accuses me of omitting information when, in fact, he just ignores all the recent releases from the FBI files. I'm just writing something about a woman named Hetty Massing who accused Alger of being a spy. And he says, I admit all this, I don't discuss all this information that he thinks backs her story up. But I spent years looking at the FBI files on her and all the contradictions in her story. And the guy doesn't even mention one. I think it's important that be included. I guess he doesn't think the FBI files are very important.
Jeff Kiseloff is the author of Rewriting History, A 50-Year Journey to Uncover the Truth About Alger Hiss. The book is published by the University Press of Kansas. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program. I appreciate you sharing with our audience this morning.
Well, I hope I was somewhat convincing.
Again, the new book is Rewriting History, A 50-Year Journey to Uncover the Truth About Alger Hiss. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.